The second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Dwayne L. Runge. For the appellant, Mr. Runge, is Mr. Robert Feit, an attorney from Brookings, and for the appellee, State of South Dakota, Ms. Katie L. Hansen, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Feit, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. As Chief Justice Gilbertson indicated, my name is Robert Feit. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Dwayne Runge. I appreciate the opportunity to present oral argument on issues which involve core fundamentals of personal rights guaranteed to citizens of the state of South Dakota under both our federal and state constitutions. It is our contention that Dwayne Runge was seized from an apartment in which he enjoyed an expectation of privacy, and that seizure by law enforcement was in violation of the protections of the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, as well as rights guaranteed under Article 6, Section 11 of the South Dakota Constitution. For purposes of my argument, the relevant facts are that on the evening of January 5, 2005, sometime after 9 o'clock p.m., Dwayne Runge had stopped at one of the fire stations in Brookings, South Dakota, looking for his friend Jeremy Jensen. After asking the whereabouts of Jensen from several of the volunteers that were assembled at the station, he was informed that Jensen was out on a fire call and was unavailable. After receiving this information, Runge drove away. But because of the encounter with the volunteers, one of the volunteers called the Brookings police station with a report of a possible intoxicated driver. Information which then became known to Brookings police officers as a result of the volunteers' report was that a male individual had been at the Brookings fire station, that he was in a possible intoxicated condition, that he had driven away in a pickup. The police were given a description of the pickup, including the license plate number. They were told the general direction the pickup was headed, and sometime later, once it was determined who the registered owner of the pickup was, they were informed that that person was Dwayne Runge. It's important to note that none of the volunteers knew Dwayne Runge, nor was any information furnished to the Brookings Police Department that Dwayne Runge was the one that was driving this vehicle that evening. Sometime later, Jensen returned to the fire station and was told that he was to call the Brookings Police Station, which he did. When he called, the police dispatcher asked him two things. First, if he knew Dwayne Runge, which he indicated that he did, and secondly, if he had any idea where Dwayne Runge might be. He had told the dispatcher that Runge very possibly could be at his apartment. This information was subsequently relayed then to Brookings police officer Collins, who had gone on duty at approximately 10 o'clock p.m. that night. Collins then proceeded to the location of Jensen's apartment building and observed the pickup in question parked in the parking lot with the motor running. At the time that he arrived, another Brookings police officer, Officer Perry, arrived, and the two of them then proceeded into the apartment building and went to Jensen's apartment, which was located on the upper floor of the apartment building. When they found Jensen's apartment, they knocked on the door, and the door was opened by a young female by the name of Jessica Haugland. She was Jeremy Jensen's girlfriend. Collins asked Haugland if either Jeremy Jensen or Travis Anderson were at home. Travis Anderson was the other renter on the lease of this particular apartment. Haugland advised that neither were at home, and at that point, Collins asked if Dwayne Runge was in the apartment. She advised that he was, and at this point, Collins testified at the preliminary hearing that he and Perry walked in to the apartment with Haugland. Now, when the Brookings police officers had first arrived at this apartment building, Dwayne Runge, who was in the apartment, went into one of the bedrooms of that apartment, and at the time the officers appeared at the door, he was still in that apartment, or in that bedroom, out of the view of the officers. Haugland went to that bedroom and told Runge that the officers wanted him to come out and talk to them. Responding to the officer's request, Runge then left the bedroom and went to the doorway where the officers were standing. And at the time that he appeared before the officers, he was drinking from a beer can and had the beer can in his hand. As soon as Runge appeared at the doorway, Collins told Runge that he wanted him to step outside and talk to him. The state argues that Runge voluntarily exited the apartment, went down the hallway, down the stairway, and exited the building to the confinement of Officer Collins' patrol car, and that because he willingly went with the officers, that there was no unlawful seizure of Runge. We disagree and believe that the evidence shows otherwise. A consensual waiver of a constitutional right must be made voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently. The state of South Dakota at the suppression hearing on this matter had the burden of showing unequivocal and specific consent by Runge to accompany the police officers out of the apartment building and into Collins' patrol car. And that showing has to be made without any duress or coercion, actual or implied.
How is that affected by the trial court's finding of lack of credibility of your client?
The trial court did not make a finding of lack of credibility of my client. In fact, the trial court made no determination of credibility of my client, nor any determination of credibility of Officer Collins.
Did the trial court make any findings about the voluntariness of your client going with the police officers?
The only findings of the trial court are found at, there's a finding of fact found at finding of fact number 17. And that finding states that Officer Collins visited with defendant briefly and asked him to come out to his patrol vehicle, and defendant voluntarily accompanied the officers to the patrol vehicle. There are no conclusions of law that make any reference to Runge's consent. Now, the trial court's memorandum opinion was incorporated into the court's findings, but that only makes one reference. Second page, fourth full paragraph of his opinion, the trial court stated, one of the officers asked the defendant to come out to his patrol car, to which request the defendant consented. Now, clearly, the findings of the trial court were not findings of fact of voluntariness. They were conclusions of law, or at best, the trial court's findings were a mixed findings of fact and conclusions of law. And I would urge the court that this situation is no different than what was before this court in the state versus Akuba, where this court found that where the trial court does not make any findings of historical fact regarding voluntariness, that issue then is reviewed de novo by this court. There's absolutely nothing in this court's findings to establish that Runge went with the officers voluntary, other than the conclusion of law. Nowhere does the record show that Runge's decision was freely and intelligently made, or that it was made without duress or coercion.
But isn't that the only conclusion you can reach from the fact that Runge didn't run back into the bedroom and hide? He didn't say, wait a minute, officer, I'm not going with you. You got no right to be here. I mean, what else can you conclude?
Well, Runge's testimony at the suppression hearing was that when he appeared at the doorway and Officer Collins asked him to come out of the apartment and talk to him, that he initially refused. He said, I don't want to leave the apartment. I don't think I need to go with you because I'm not doing anything wrong. And then Collins then persisted and asked again. Runge testified at the suppression hearing that that Collins became agitated, and that the second time that he made the request to Runge, that Runge felt he had no choice but to comply. He testified that he made the decision to leave with Officer Collins because Collins was getting mad and he didn't want him to get mad at him and restrain him. And that's the reason that he left the apartment. And getting back to Chief Justice Gilbertson's question, the trial court never made any finding of credibility on Runge's testimony on that point. Never found that Collins' testimony was more believable than Runge's. Never ruled on the credibility of even Collins' testimony on that point. It's important to note that when Runge testified at the suppression hearing and said what I just stated that he said, the state never even chose to cross-examine him on that point. Not a single question was posed to Runge about his his saying that I didn't want to go with Officer Collins, the only reason I did was because I didn't want him to get mad and restrain me. And I told him that I didn't think I was doing anything wrong and didn't need to go with him. And the prosecution chose not to call either Officer Collins or Officer Perry, that were both present during this exchange, to testify and to refute that testimony. Instead, the state chose to rely solely upon the testimony that Collins had given at the preliminary hearing in this matter. And basically, at the preliminary hearing of this matter, Collins said that he didn't have a problem with Runge because Runge went along with what he consented to his wishes. You know, he didn't have a problem because Runge decided to come with him. But Collins' testimony at the preliminary hearing doesn't go to the heart of the consent issue. Collins never testified at the preliminary hearing that Runge's actions were voluntary. I had asked him on cross-examination whether Collins' actions were voluntary, and his response was, I asked him to come with me, and he came with me. Now, Collins further testified at the preliminary hearing that he had activated his audio recording prior to going up to Jensen's apartment. He testified at the preliminary hearing that he had not reviewed that audio tape, but that the conversation between he and Dwayne Runge should have been recorded on that audio tape. At the suppression hearing, there was no introduction of this tape recording of this conversation between Officer Collins and Runge, nor was any explanation offered as to why that tape recording, that audio recording, was unavailable. Runge's testimony and Collins's testimony are not contradictory. In fact, Runge did eventually comply with Officer Collins's request. And for that reason, Collins didn't have a problem with him. But Runge's orderly submission to that request can never be, by itself, serve as a basis for finding voluntary consent. The presence of two officers at the door and Collins' repeated insistence that Runge come out and talk to him would have conveyed to a reasonable person that they were not at liberty to ignore the officer's demands.
But Mr. Feitz, you've argued just a moment ago that it was a subjective thing, and now you're arguing it's an objective standard. Which is it? You said before your client went along voluntarily because he thought he had to. Now you're talking about what a reasonable person would do, and that's the standard, not what your client may have internally been worried about. Isn't that the case?
Well, I agreed. Justice Center, it is a reasonable standard, but I think a reasonable person can look at Runge's position and conclude that a reasonable person would have felt the same way that he did. When an officer doesn't take no for an answer, when you tell the officer you don't think you should have to go with him because you're not doing anything wrong, and he doesn't accept that as an answer and repeats his request and you know, we can talk semantics, whether he asked or told, but we all know that tone and inflection make a big difference, and that a reasonable person could have felt that they had no choice but to comply with the officer's demand. So I would agree it's a reasonable person standard, but a reasonable person in Runge's position, I think, would have felt the same way that he would have. Upon a show of authority by the police officers, the Fourth Amendment does not require Runge to risk physical confrontation or a charge of resisting arrest in order to preserve his constitutional rights. I want to talk briefly about Runge's expectation of privacy in the apartment. As we contended in our brief, we do believe that Runge had an expectation of privacy in the apartment, and because of the fact that he did not voluntarily consent to leave that apartment and go with the officers to Collins' patrol car, probable cause, not reasonable suspicion, is required to justify the investigatory detention of him. At the time the officers encountered Runge at the apartment, they did not have probable cause to arrest Runge. In fact, they didn't even know that he was the person that drove the vehicle that evening. The only question that Collins asked Runge at the apartment is, are you Dwayne Runge? To which he indicated that he was. At that point is when Officer Collins told Runge that he wanted him to come out of the apartment and come down to the patrol car and talk about it. So the officers, as they arrived at that apartment, and even after they encountered Runge, did not have probable cause to effect an arrest. And clearly, Runge had an expectation of privacy in this apartment. At the time of this incident, the testimony at the suppression hearing established that Jensen was Dwayne Runge's closest friend. They had known each other for 17 years. They had grown up together. They lived a few blocks from each other. They'd often attended each other's family events. They'd frequently socialized together. They'd been in each other's weddings, and they'd spent numerous overnights at each other's residences. Both considered the other welcome to come over at any time and socialize and spend the night if they desired. Jensen testified that Runge had spent numerous overnights at this particular apartment during the year and a half that he had lived there. In addition to those overnights, Runge had frequently been at that apartment to socialize with Jensen, watch TV, play cards, and relax. Jensen testified that their relationship was such that Runge did not need to give advance notice, and customarily Runge just showed up. He testified that Runge knew he was welcome to come over at any time and spend the night if he desired. And Jensen also testified that Runge had his absolute permission to be in that apartment on January 5th. In holding that Runge did not have an expectation of privacy, the trial court placed emphasis on the fact that Runge had not been specifically invited that evening to come over. Because of that, the trial court in its conclusions held that Runge was just a mere visitor or uninvited social guest. These findings are not supported by the testimony of Runge, Jensen, or Haugland. As testified by Jensen, Runge had an open invitation to come over at any time. Based upon their relationship, Runge was always an invited social guest of Jensen's. The relationship, custom, and practice existing between the two of them established that Runge had a subjective expectation of privacy in this apartment. And if you look at Jensen's or at Runge's actions taken that evening, they clearly demonstrate his familiarity and control over that apartment, as well as his subjective expectation of privacy. He showed up unannounced. He let himself into the apartment. He opened the closed door of the bathroom to see who was in there taking a shower. He helped himself to beer from the refrigerator. He turned on the television, went in and sat down and watched TV. When the police arrived, he entered one of the apartment's bedrooms, only coming out after being told by Haugland that the police officers wanted to talk to him. Runge further told Collins that he did not want to leave the apartment, and he didn't think he needed to go because he wasn't doing anything wrong. In its memorandum opinion, the court stated that Runge had
2 minutes.
Had not been in Jensen's apartment for at least 4 months, and that was cited as one of his reasons for not believing Runge. But that finding is clearly contradicted by the testimony of Runge, Jensen, and Haugland. Jensen testified in that preceding three-month period after Haugland had moved in, that Runge had been at the apartment on several occasions to socialize. On at least one of those occasions, he testified that Runge had spent at least part of the night sleeping on the sofa. Haugland also acknowledged at the suppression hearing that Runge was frequently at the apartment and that she wasn't surprised that he had shown up unannounced on the evening of January 5th, 2005.
So I have a question then. Are you challenging the findings of fact, or are you saying that under the facts that were found by the trial court that the conclusion of law is that he did have an expectation of privacy?
Well, I am challenging the findings. I think the judge placed emphasis on the fact that Runge was not intending to stay overnight and used that as his main reason for not granting the expectation of privacy. And I think the trial court misunderstood the facts of the case when he found in his findings that Runge had not been there during the preceding four-month period.
So you are saying that some of the facts are clearly erroneous?
Yes, I am. And I think the facts of this case are not unlike the facts that were before this court in the Hess and Tullis decisions. And applying the court's reasoning in those two cases, I believe that Runge clearly met his burden of proof in showing that he had an expectation of privacy in that apartment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pite. Ms. Hansen, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Katie Hansen. As previously mentioned, I'm an assistant attorney general and I'm representing the state. The first question that the defendant brings up in his brief is whether he had an expectation of privacy at the residence of 830 Park Avenue Apartment 9. It was not his residence, so there's a question of whether or not he was entitled to an expectation of privacy in a home that was not his own.
Let's assume for a minute that he does have a reasonable expectation of privacy because he's been there so many times and he's come and gone without being asked or without being invited. Okay, does the state lose then?
I don't believe so, for the simple fact of any expectation of privacy he might have had. I think Jessica Haugland's permission for the police to enter overrides his expectation of privacy because she was a resident at that apartment.
Okay, but isn't the first question whether or not the officer had reasonable suspicion to make a stop and, for example, to talk to Mr. Runge?
Yes, and I believe he did have reasonable suspicion to stop to talk to Mr. Runge.
All right, and then let's assume that the trial court judge was correct in finding that Mr. Runge voluntarily went with the officers downstairs because they didn't want to run him through a drug test or a DWI test in the living room of that apartment. Okay. And if that's been voluntary to that point, then why can't the officer take whatever information he gets and whatever information comes from the DWI test?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Why can't he?
What prevents the officer from observing Mr. Runge doing the DUI test and whatever, and the answering the questions that he asked him?
I don't believe anything would prevent him from taking that information. If the officer had reasonable suspicion to detain him in the apartment for a brief investigation, then took him out to do these sobriety tests.
All right. So then, is it immaterial whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy or not?
I don't believe it's immaterial whether he has an expectation of privacy, but I believe part of their issue was whether the police officers had authority to enter the apartment building because of his expectation of privacy in that apartment. And I believe that expectation, well, any expectation of privacy he might have had, which I don't believe he did, was superseded by Jessica Haugland's authority to let people in as she wished.
Could you address the voluntary question? Because counsel says that there was no finding about the credibility of his client, and so how do we come to a determination that he voluntarily left with the officer as opposed to being required to leave?
I think the trial court did make a finding of credibility when it chose to believe Officer Collins' testimony at the preliminary hearing. I believe had he chose to believe defendant's testimony, he would have stated so in the findings of facts, but instead chose to believe that of Officer Collins, the defendant did go willingly outside with him. So I think right there, when he decides which testimony to put down as a finding of fact, right there is a finding of credibility that he chose to believe Officer Collins over the defendant. The defendant cites a couple of cases in support of his contention that the defendant had an expectation of privacy. He cites State v. Tullis and State v. Hess as supporting that someone can have an expectation of privacy when they're not necessarily an overnight guest. Um, in, And in the first case of State v. Hess, the trial court or the Supreme Court made several findings about why the defendant had a expectation of privacy, and a couple of those were that he had spent several nights at the apartment with his girlfriend. He had spent the night on several, or he had spent the entire afternoon there. He had a backpack there, and he was free to go to his bedroom, his girlfriend's bedroom, and close the door. And then in State v. Tullis, the Supreme Court found that the defendant in that case, he had an expectation of privacy for the simple fact that the defendant or his friend had given him a key, allowing him to enter the apartment when he wasn't there. Now, the trial court, in its decision, made several findings on those type of factors, and his first one was that defendant was not the owner of the apartment. He did not have a key to the apartment. He did not store property at the apartment. He was not an overnight guest at the apartment that night. He was not invited on that particular night to the apartment. He let himself in, and it was clear that he did not intend to stay for a significant amount of time at that apartment because his car was running outside in the parking lot. I think in those two cases, it shows that the defendant needed to have some kind of semblance of control over the apartment, or needed to have more factors concluding that he had the right to be in there. And I think they're putting a lot of emphasis on the fact that he had spent the night there a couple of times, when in fact he had spent the night there, by his own testimony, two or three times in the past year and a half. And since Jessica Haugland had moved in, he had not really spent the night there. He had simply fallen asleep while waiting for his wife to pick him up. So while he may have at one point had the status, more of a status of a social guest or an overnight guest, at the time when Jessica Haugland moved in, that status might have changed. And I don't believe that just for the simple, I think that the pass between the defendant and Runge is something to be considered, but I don't think that necessarily gives him the status of an overnight guest or the status of someone closer to an overnight guest on all occasions that he is at that apartment. I think you have to look at it as a case-by-case factor and have to look at all the facts of the situation at the present time. And if you look at the facts of the situation at the present time, he hadn't been there. He hadn't stayed the night in over 3 months. He had to let himself in. Nobody let him in. Nobody invited him in. And while he says that shows familiarity, I think that just shows that he maybe was someone who was legitimately on the premises, but he was not someone that was invited in to socialize. And if they find that he did have somewhat reasonable expectation of privacy, I believe Jessica Haugland's consent overrides his expectation of privacy.
Can she give consent for the police to come in and seize the defendant?
I don't believe she gave him permission to come in and seize them. I believe she gave him permission to come inside, and I believe she did have that authority because she was residing at that apartment.
But isn't the seizure what he's challenging here?
I don't believe that there was a seizure. I think it's somewhat similar to a traffic stop. When you have reasonable suspicion, you're allowed to detain a defendant for a short investigation, which is what the officers, they had reasonable suspicion to believe that he had been driving intoxicated.
Except they didn't actually go in the apartment and question him in the apartment.
That is true. Once they found out it was Dwayne Runge, though, the officer did make several observations, such as his eyes were bloodshot. His speech
was... He made that while he was in the apartment or afterwards?
I believe he made it while he was in the apartment. That his speech was slurred, he was slightly staggering, and that his eyes were bloodshot. And so based on that, he took him outside to... presumably to do field sobriety tests and to go to his patrol car to check his license, check for outstanding warrants, which is allowed in a routine traffic stop. You're allowed to detain them.
Okay, but let's assume for purposes of the discussion here is that this was his own home and he had a right to privacy and that wasn't an issue. Then could the police officers still have done what they did here? What if they came to, if he was in his own apartment under the same facts, could they seize him if they looked at his eyes and they were watery and whatever else you said that you thought they observed?
I don't believe so. I believe probably he would have had more of an expectation of privacy, but because...
Then they would have to get a warrant, and there had to be probable cause or other than exceptions, exigent circumstances and something like that.
Yes, correct? I believe so, yes.
But they can ask him to come down to the sidewalk or the street for further questions and so forth, can't they?
I believe so. I believe that that's part of the investigation process. They can detain him for that short period of time as to do a little more investigation and to check his registration.
Even if it was in his own home, it's his own apartment, and he clearly has a right of expectation of privacy. The officer at that stage could ask him to come on down because it's a better place to ask questions, right?
I agree with that, yes.
So you don't need to be able to establish that he did not have an expectation of privacy in order to win this case.
I agree with that, I guess.
Now why?
Because technically I don't think there was a seizure. I think so therefore his rights were not violated. But I mean, his Fourth Amendment rights to unreasonable search and seizure were not violated because there was no seizure. They simply detained him for a short investigation based on reasonable suspicion, which they are allowed to do.
Thank you.
And as far as the consent issue goes, in a case that they cited in their brief in United States versus Menendahl, in that case, respondent was a young female, and she was observed in an airport by two agents of the DEA, and the agents observed her conduct, and it appeared to her, and appeared to be that she had the characteristics of a person unlawfully carrying narcotics. The agents approached her, asked her to see an ID and an airline ticket, and after questioning her, they asked her to accompany them to the DEA airport office, which she did. She didn't give really a verbal response, she just accompanied them. The respondent argued that they could not ascertain that that was consent because she merely followed them, but the United States Supreme Court found that the respondent voluntarily consented to accompany the officers to the office, and that the evidence showed that the government's showed that respondent was not told that she had to accompany the officers. She was just simply asked, and that is the situation in this case. Runge was simply asked to accompany them, which he did. So as far as, the United States Supreme Court has found that the fact that the respondent simply following them to that office was enough to ascertain consent, and I think we have the same situation here, and that he did follow them down. So if they find that it was some type of seizure and he needed consent, I think it can be ascertained that consent was given by him following the police officer down to the police car.
Do we have to address if we find there's consent, do we have to address the right of privacy issue in order to get to the consent?
If they're first arguing that the entry into the apartment was illegal, then yes, but if not, then I don't believe so. My understanding was that their first argument was that the police officer's entry into the apartment was illegal because of his expectation of privacy. Therefore, they needed something to get into the apartment.
So we would have to address it before we get to the consent?
I believe so. If nobody else has any more questions, I would ask that the court affirm the trial court's decision to deny the motion to suppress.
Would you like some more questions?
I'd prefer not, but if you have any more, I'll gladly answer them.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early. Thank you. Mr. Feit, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I just want to address the expectation of privacy briefly. I think it's important to note that when Jeremy Jensen talked to the police dispatcher, and the police dispatcher asked if he had any ideas where Dwayne Runge might be headed, he said, probably to my apartment. which certainly shows that there was a custom between the two where Runge was spending a great deal of time socializing with Jensen at his apartment. The third-party consent issue, and I realize that we probably have a bit of an uphill battle on this one, but at the preliminary hearing, and again, the only testimony ever offered by the state from any of the police officers was by Collins at the preliminary hearing. But Collins testified at the preliminary hearing that he and Officer Perry walked in to the apartment with Jessica Haugland. Never said that he asked consent or can we enter. Said, as he recalled, he said, we just walked in. And they stood at the doorway, which would seem to indicate that they did just walk in. Now, Jessica Haugland was called by the state at the suppression hearing, and she said that she invited the officers to step inside the apartment. So either way, there probably was a limited invitation for the officers to step inside the doorway. But the officers at that point they knew who the two renters of the apartment were because they specifically asked for Jeremy Jensen and Travis Anderson. So they never made any inquiries about Haugland as to whether she had any actual or apparent authority to enter the apartment. And I think that's why they never did anything other than just walk in and stand at the doorway, because they didn't know her from Adam and didn't know what kind of authority she might have in the apartment. And Jessica Haugland testified that she went and got Dwayne Runge from the bedroom. It is not reasonable to assume that she would have done that on her own volition without the officers telling her that they wanted to talk to Dwayne Runge. And, you know, it's our position that Jessica Haugland would have given them at most a limited invitation to step inside the doorway.
Counsel, that's all speculation. I mean, we have to decide this case on what we have, not on what somebody might imply or speculate upon.
Well, there's nothing in the record to reflect that there was any more of an invitation given by her. All she said was she invited them in, and they stood by the doorway while she went and got Dwayne Runge from the bedroom.
And there's no testimony by Runge that he refused to come out, and he said, I'm not coming out unless the officers come in and get me.
No.
Nothing like that.
No, Runge testified that he came out because of the request of the officers, that she told him that the officers wanted him to come out and talk to them, and that's why he left the bedroom.
But there's nothing illegal about that.
No.
I mean, there's really no dispute that he voluntarily came from the bedroom to where the officers were at the doorway.
No, at the request of the officers, he did so.
And there's nothing illegal about that, is there? The police officers can ask somebody to come out and talk.
You know, our contention is that by having Runge, or having Jessica Haugland get Runge out of the bedroom, the officers did more than they could have done, that they did not have authority to go to the bedroom and ask Runge to come out of the bedroom. They used Haugland for that purpose, and that exceeded the scope of the authority that they were given to step into the apartment. And that's simply our contention, that they used her to get him out of the bedroom, where they would not have had the authority to enter into the apartment, to go into the center of the apartment and go to that bedroom and have Dwayne Runge exit the bedroom.
What if they stood at the doorway and said, Mr. Runge, come on out, we need to talk to you?
That would have been appropriate.
What's the difference? What's the substantial difference?
That they did not do that. I mean, they...
But I mean, what difference does it make?
I think it makes a difference where you've got an individual that actually enters within, you know, goes beyond the scope of the authority that was given. In this case, they would have exceeded their authority by having her go to the bedroom and have him come out. And I think her actions are imputed to the officers because, you know, she was a messenger for the officers. And You know, and I realize there's, you know, it's a tough argument, but that's our position. And I think if there is no third party consent to enter the apartment, then obviously any of the case stops there. The suppression should be granted. Now, if you assume that there is third party consent, the officers were justified in entering the apartment, then we get on to the expectation of privacy argument. And if there's an expectation of privacy in the apartment, the officers needed probable cause to do an investigatory detention, not reasonable suspicion. And, you know, it's clear from a fair reading of the trial court's decision that he considered this a highway traffic stop. He says in his memorandum opinion, this is no different than if the defendant had been encountered outside on the highway a short distance from his vehicle. And the whole opinion of the trial court is that Collins and Perry were justified in doing an investigatory detention of Runge because of the report of a possible intoxicated driver. Now, we agree that when the officers Collins and Perry went to that apartment building, they had reasonable suspicion to investigate this report. And if you assume, for the sake of argument, that Runge did not have an expectation of privacy in that apartment, the officers could have done an investigatory detention of Runge at the apartment. I think that is permissible under Terry versus Ohio, and it falls within the narrow constraints of that decision that allow that type of detention on something less than probable cause. Where the officers exceeded their authority was when they did not question Runge at all at the apartment. Rather, they took him out of the apartment, down the stairs, outside the apartment building, and placed him in the confines of the patrol car. And the case law is clear that once you exceed that the least intrusive method for doing your investigatory detention, you've exceeded the authorization that the law enforcement officers are given under Terry versus the Terry case. If Collins and assuming again, if there was no reasonable expectation of privacy, Collins and Perry could have done an investigatory detention at the apartment building and found out the facts of this report of a possible drinking driver, but they did not do so. And I think that's where they exceeded their bounds.
And this really hinges, doesn't this case, it's different from some of our prior cases where we've talked about reasonable suspicion and so forth, is that this is the confines of someone's home.
Exactly.
And that there are stronger protections against police entering someone's home. Is that correct?
That's very correct, Justice Meyer Henry. And throughout this whole proceeding, the state has always argued that there's a distinction between a person's home versus Runge being in this apartment, even if he has an expectation of privacy. And when you look at all the case law in that, the law is clear that the courts draw no distinction between whether a person is in their own home or in a place where they have an expectation of privacy. The same rules apply. One final point, I would further urge this court to apply the burden of proof of clear and convincing as opposed to a preponderance of the evidence. And I'm mindful of the court's decision in Akuba, but I think a distinction can be drawn between consents to allow searches of possessions versus seizures of the person. And in this case, arguably, questions of seizure of a person are far more invasive to personal liberties than a search of possessions. Dwayne Runge lived his life in South Dakota. We're taught in South Dakota typically to be cooperative to law enforcement, and cooperation's encouraged. We respect law enforcement. And the retention of the clear and convincing standard with respect to seizures of the person would ensure accountability from law enforcement while still allowing law enforcement to operate in a manageable framework. You know, most, I think approximately half of the states still require a standard higher than preponderance of the evidence.
Your time has expired, Mr. Pyatt. Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.
Losing someone that you love. Step outside with me and look for a star as we play Dust to Stardust.
You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com. You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com.
The third case for oral argument this morning is Ivan Fuller Appellant versus Croston and Caldwell Banker Appellees. For the appellant, Mr. Fuller is Mr. Patrick Glover, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for Caldwell Banker is Mr. Stephen Landon, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for Croston's is Mr. Joel Boss, an attorney from Sioux City, Iowa. Now, I understand Mr. Landon will be speaking for 10 minutes and then Mr. Boss for 10 minutes. Is that correct, counsel? All right. Very well. Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself in this matter, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, former justice of this court, to sit in Justice Meyer Henry's stead. Mr. Glover, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Members of the court, counsel. This case, we're involving a purchase of a real estate house here in the city of Sioux Falls. The pertinent facts to this case are Fuller is the buyer. He met with the Crostons, who were the original owners of the house. They were the only ones who have ever lived there. They gave Mr. Fuller a residential real estate disclosure statement, which is required by South Dakota law. In that disclosure statement, they put that there was never any prior water damage in the house and that there was no cracking in the basement walls, even though they knew for a fact that there was prior water damage and that there were cracks in the basement walls. During a walk through the house, Mr. Fuller noticed some signs of prior water damage, and he inquired to the Crossings about it. And at this time, they admitted then that, yes, we had had water damage two or three times before, but it had ceased upon us building a sunroom. There was a patio to the east side of the house. Mr. Croston had said that it collected water at that point. He removed the cement patio, put a sunroom and a porch in over there, and stated that since then there has been no problems. The sunroom was put on approximately 1977. And around the same time, there was some wood paneling put on the walls in the basement. Mr. Fuller took them for their word that there was no continual problem with the place, that it was taken care of and the water had seeped in since then. He went ahead and purchased the house, only to find about a year and a half later to have severe water penetration to the basement. When it was went through and the damages were inspected and they were looking at what was wrong with the house, it was brought to Mr. Fuller's attention that there was actually a severe water problem in that basement, and it looked like it had been continually happening in that basement. It did not stop in 1977. So Mr. Fuller filed a complaint against the Crostons and their real estate agent for the damages he sustained from the water penetration and the cracks in the wall. Now, under South Dakota law, it's section 43, or chapter 43, section 4. There are some statutes in there that deal with the disclosure statements. One of those, 43440, states that a seller is not liable for any defect or any other condition in the property being transferred as long as they truthfully complete the disclosure statement. Now, the Crostons failed to truthfully complete it, but there is a savings clause, if you want to call it, in 43438 that allows a seller to furnish a written amendment to the disclosure statement should they find something that is a material defect in the house after signing the disclosure statement. Now, in this case, there was no written amendment to it, and the real question comes down to, does the oral admissions of the Crostons and the knowledge that Mr. Fuller may have gleaned off of a inspection report that he had done at his expense absolve the Crostons and their real estate agent of any liability under South Dakota law for the damages that were done to the house that he now owns? And it is my client's contention that because they failed to truthfully complete that disclosure statement and that they never gave any written amendment to it, that it does not. South Dakota case law states that these disclosure statements create a contract between the two parties. And under contract law, written always trumps oral. Now, whether he was notified of it or not, there is nothing cited from the defendants in this case that gives them the right, or it says that an oral representation shall absolve them of any liability under a disclosure statement.
But the point that you're making here would lead to the result that if I was buying a house and I didn't put it in the disclosure statement, but when I got there to look at it, the homeowner told me, well, this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong. And I say, well, I'm willing to live with that. And I go ahead and buy the house. You're saying that even in that circumstance, they would be liable then for not having correctly filled out the written statement. Even though I knew everything that was defective, if that written statement's not filled out, there's liability.
Correct. I think under the South Dakota law, the way these disclosure statement laws are written, that it has to be something in writing to absolve you of liability.
How have you been harmed if you know the risk, you know that you're buying a house with a defective basement or a defective garage or whatever it might be?
Well, in this case, I believe what he knew and what was really the damages are not the same. What he was told was there was prior water damage, yes, but that it had ceased. What the evidence shows is there was continual water damage and that it never did cease. And there is evidence that shows that the Crostons were aware of it. They stated that they built that sunroom in 77 and that alleviated the problem. They then put paneling on the basement walls. Mr. Croston noticed a dark spot on the panel, and that's what prompted him to ask his real estate agent whether he needs to disclose it or not. So that shows that he acknowledged that even after they had built the sunroom, that there was continual water damage. By his own admission, he said that it was done. That's what he admitted. We had water damage. Once you put that sunroom on, we didn't have any more, so it's taken care of. You don't have to worry about it.
So your argument is not that it just was not in writing, but that there was full disclosure. Your argument is that the verbal disclosure was not complete.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so in answer to Justice Zinner's question, even though the law requires a written disclosure, somebody could comply if they had a verbal full disclosure?
I believe that they could comply if it was completely fully done. There is no law that we can point to say that, but I believe if they truthfully completed with the oral representations, that it would be a lot better situation for the defendants in this case, yes.
And if that's the case, there's an issue of fact?
Yes, there's a genuine issue of fact of what the homeowners knew or the defendants knew of to the extent of the prior water damage at the time that they signed the disclosure statement and made the oral representations to Mr. Fuller.
Well, with the inspection report, would your client have known as much as the Crustons knew before they, I mean, they had the inspection and they got the inspection report. So together with what the Crostons admitted and with that report, would your clients have, your client would have known as much as the Crostons at the time they went ahead and sealed the deal?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The Crostons had the years of living there. They knew that there was prior water damage there. The inspection report merely noticed that there was signs of past dampness in the basement. Nothing to worry about, they look old. What other evidence shows was that there was, yes, there was signs of past dampness, but that there was also extensive damage from a continual water penetration to the basement.
Now you say other evidence. Now this is evidence that was discovered after your client closed on the house and began living in the house?
Yes, it was evidence from people that came in to do repairs to the basement after the water had caused damage to the walls and to the floors.
Did I hear you say that they were the first people to live in the house?
Yes, the house was, I don't know if it was a spec house or it was built by a party, but the Crostons bought it from the builders and lived in it from, I believe, 69 until they sold it.
Okay, so this damage behind the paneling is not something that was put up as a facade by them. It was something that was there that they were not aware of either. Fair statement?
No, the paneling was put up by the Crostons in around 77.
Okay.
It was after they had water damage, and then they supposedly corrected it with this sunroom or this taking the patio out, that they said corrected it. They did that in 77. And then also that year, by their testimony, they put the paneling up.
To cover the crumbling.
They never said that. So.
They never said that, but that's what was behind the paneling.
That's an issue that's still...
That's still an issue of fact.
There was crumbling walls. There was rust on some of the pipes back there. There was the sheet. They put it over the sheetrock, so the sheetrock would just crumble in your hands when you took it out. From what the people who went down there to correct the problem said. As far as the garage roof goes, there was an addendum entered into that was to fix a sag in the garage roof. Now there's some dispute as whether it was to fix it or whether it was to just jack and add a support beam.
What did the contract say?
The contract said jack and add support beam.
And what happened?
The garage roof was jacked in the spot of the sag, and two 2x4s were put in there. Good. But from Mr.
What do you assert was in that contract that did not occur?
I assert my client asserts that the contract addendum was written to fix the sag in the garage roof. By coincidence, or by reason that it says to jack and add support beam, is what was in the inspection report on how to fix the sag. They didn't know how to do it, they being the defendants, they called and asked the inspector, what do we need to do to fix that sag? He suggested you'll need to jack it and add a support beam. That was done, it was jacked and the support beam was done, but the clear intention of the parties was to have that sag fixed. And a year and a half after the jack and added, that sag was not fixed. It was back, and it was even worse than before.
But it was your client's, it's your client's employee that suggested how to fix it, or agent at least. It was, they hired the inspector. The inspector said, here's how to fix it.
Right.
And it was fixed according to what the inspector said should be done.
Crossens called and asked him his suggestion on how to fix it. And that was his suggestion, is to, you need to jack the spot up and add a support beam.
And they did that?
Yes. But this is a home inspection guy. He's not a contractor.
But is that the fault of the buyer or the seller?
They relied on his. It was their responsibility to have it fixed correctly, and they relied on him to have it fixed. So, yes, I would believe that it was their fault for relying on someone who was not a contractor to tell them how to do it.
Now, the statutes say that this disclosure statement does not constitute a warranty, correct?
Correct.
Aren't we getting awful close to that?
Yes, we're getting close, but I think the point that it's not that they're warning against any and all water penetration or cracks in the basement. It's that the defendants knew there was damage down there. They failed to disclose it. And then there's a dispute as to whether they knew that it was continually happening and just chose not to disclose that. As far as, I'd like to touch just briefly on the other defendants in this case. We've mostly been talking about the Crossens, Janie Johnson and Caldwell Banker. It is my client's opinion that the liability arises for them in this case because there is testimony, albeit disputed testimony, that the Crossens, you know, were aware of this prior water damage and sought counsel from Janie Johnson, their real estate agent at Coldwell Banker, on how do we handle this? Do we need to disclose this? And by the Crossens testimony, Ms. Johnson replied, do you have it under control? It was a long time ago. It hasn't happened. Don't worry about it. Answer no. So under the advice of their real estate agent, the Crossens answered no to the prior crack, to the cracks in the basement, and to water penetration in the house.
Didn't she deny that conversation,
though? She did deny that conversation, and that's where we run into another disputed fact in this case on what really did happen here. We can't tell. Crossens both say that she did. She, of course, says she didn't. And she said she tells all of her clients that you must be completely honest in those disclosure statements or it'll come back and get you.
And the trial court let her off the hook and GKR off the hook and left the Crossens off the hook.
Right. Okay. The trial court, in essence, decided or held that Mr. Fuller was given enough notice of the defects in the house to put him on notice himself so that he cannot come back and claim liability on it. Position today, my client's position is, he was given notice, yes, by the Crossens, but it was not sufficient notice. There is some disputed facts as to how much knowledge they had in this basement, either defendants had in the damage to the basement. Responsible for not truthfully answering the disclosure statement to begin with. And not to jump back, but on that roof, a real quick point. On the garage roof, it seemed from the decision of the trial court that his decision didn't really touch on the roof itself. It was discussed, and then at the end, his decision seemed to be based solely, decision was on the cracks and the water penetration of the basement. But I had cited some, back to the other defendants, Johnsons, I had cited some statutes. And the first one, I think, that helps spell out liability for Janie Johnson Caldwell Banker is SDCL 3621A148. And that one says, to paraphrase it, that the real estate agent is only liable for misrepresentations if they knew of them. And obviously in this case, Ms. Johnson knew, or at least there's disputed evidence that she knew of these misrepresentations. So this is not a statute that allows the defendants, Janie Johnson and Caldwell Banker, off the hook. it's something that just reaffirms the fact that they knew, and yet they chose to go in the wrong direction, in my client's opinion. That's all I have at this time, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Landon, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. I'm representing Coldwell Banker, G. Caron Associates, and Janie Johnson. And I'll be dealing specifically with the issues against those two defendants. For example, I won't be talking about the roof, as I understand that that claim was made. The failure to repair or the failure to complete the work in the addendum was made solely against the Crossnets. Before I start with the argument, I do want to just touch on the facts real briefly. Justice Miller asked a couple of questions about kind of the history of this. My understanding is all of these facts that I'm going to present to you are undisputed. The Crostons bought the house from a contractor at the stage where they could pick out carpeting and pick out paint colors and things of that nature. The house was up. My understanding is that it was something, I believe Mr. Glover referred to, something like a spec home. I think that's the condition it was at the time. Fall, Labor Day of 1969, they moved in. They're the only people besides Mr. Fuller that have ever lived there. So they know all there is to know about the house, to the extent there's anything to know. The four-season room was put in, according to Mr. Croston, in fall of 1975. Now, this prior water penetration, and I always take issue a little bit with the disclosure statement, it refers to prior water penetration problems. Regardless of how you want to parse that, the prior water penetration, according to Mr. Croston, was two or three times there was a little bit of water that came in from that porch. That porch was gone after fall of 1975. There was a four-season room put on, and according to Mr. Croston, and there's no dispute in the record for this testimony, they never had water in the basement again, that he ever knew about it. The paneling issue that Justice Miller was asking about was, according to Mr. Croston, they decided they wanted to finish off the basement. So in 1977, he got some deal somewhere, Schoenemans or someplace, on half-inch wood paneling. There's no evidence that there was anything wrong with the cinder block walls, the foundation walls, way back in 1977 when he put that on. There's no evidence that he was covering anything up, that there's any pictures from before or anything like that. I'm sure the court's familiar with Engelhardt versus Kramer. This is not that case. That case, I think, you know, the facts were just egregious. Wasn't it 4 days before the house was listed for sale? The owner of the house put paneling up to cover walls that there were huge cracks in, but all the cement had leached out. Essentially, the walls were falling down. She had pictures of the before and after, offered at one point to show the prospective buyer to take the paneling off. Of course, the buyer, not knowing if she was going to buy, said, no, you don't have to take those off. But never showed the pictures. The seller never showed the pictures to show that the walls were falling down. This is not that case. Again, the facts are very clear and undisputed that from 1977 on, this half-inch paneling stayed on those walls, and that no one ever knew that there was any problem with it after that. Now, I do want to, I guess, respond to one thing. Mr. Glover talked about repair people offering opinions. First of all, there's nothing in the record about that other than hearsay from Mr. Fuller. Once the defendants moved for summary judgment, there were no affidavits, there was no sworn testimony of anyone who did any work on the house coming forward with any opinion as to what the condition of the house was. The undisputed testimony is that the Crostons had watered two or three times in the distant past. By distant, I mean prior to 1975, and nothing past that point. So that's the status of the record. That's the facts that happened when you get up to now, fall of 2002, when the Crostons decide that not because they're selling a pig in a poke, but because they want to move to a twin home, a more condominium living because they're retiring, that's when they decide to sell their family home. Their kids had grown and gone, and they decided to sell the house. Now, I represent their agent. Janie Johnson, a Coldwell Banker, agreed to list the house for them. I can't remember which justice asked the question, but the question was about the disclosure statement. There is a dispute as to whether any conversation ever took place between Janie Johnson for Coldwell Banker and the Crostons about what to put on the disclosure statement. As we've addressed in our brief, I think both defendants addressed that, though, the issue here is whether that conversation is material, whether that conversation precludes summary judgment. Obviously, we're here because our position is that the circuit court properly granted summary judgment because none of the damage that Mr. Croston incurred in this matter was the result of whether or not Janie Johnson told Jim and Patricia Croston anything. Here, the causal connection was broken. But nothing about this disclosure statement went any further than two things. One, the Crostons' voluntary discussions with Mr. Fuller about the condition of this house. That's the first thing. There was no bright lights and there was no interrogation. This was a matter of people discussing the house. And regardless of what was on this written disclosure statement, Mr. Fuller asked the question. And what's interesting is why he asked the question. He asked because he noticed things. He noticed flaking of paint on these block walls. We've all seen cinder block walls. He noticed the flaking. In response to that, they didn't try to cover anything up. There was no, you know, there's no claim in this case that there was some runaround about what happened. Instead, the clear evidence is that Mr. Croston said, oh yeah, we had water here in the basement back, you know, many years ago. Put the four-season room on and we haven't had water since. That's different, again, than Engelhardt versus Kramer. It's also different than the Parmalee case. In that case, there was a long written disclosure that arguably was a nice artful dodge around what everybody knew was going to continue to happen. Here, no dispute that Mr. Croston told him what he knew. In addition, then, after that conversation where Mr. Croston said, here's what happened, here's what we think we've taken care of, and heck, we've lived here for another 25 years, nothing ever happened. After that, Mr. Fuller, as was his right under the contract, had a professional inspection done. There's a couple things that are important about that inspection. One, it appears to be a thorough inspection. And two, it was completely consistent with what Mr. Croston had already heard from Mr. Fuller. Evidence of past water appears to be old. Slight bowing in the walls, cracking in the walls, puttying. You know, we've all seen those mortar blocks. Mr. Croston's testimony was, not because water came in, but because it looked bad, he puttied over it and painted. Again, there's not an implication, nor has one been raised, that that was to defraud anyone. It was because he was maintaining his home. Now, the second thing that's interesting about the inspection report is, after he got the inspection report, Mr. Fuller admitted that he read it, understood it, and decided to go forward anyway. Everybody knew what the Crostons knew. Everybody knew what, arguably, according to this dispute, Janie Johnson knew. Janie Johnson did not have any obligation under the statutes to disclose anything. She's the seller's agent. Potentially, you know, and scratching your head and thinking, what's Janie Johnson doing? Potentially, there may be a claim by the Crostons, if that's going to be their claim, that Janie Johnson misled them into inappropriately or improperly completing the disclosure statement. Potentially, they have a claim against their agent. But there's not a claim here that Janie Johnson ever had any direct communication with Mr. Fuller at all. That's different than some cases. There are cases where the agent, in a walkthrough, makes representations. And then the agent always says, well, but that's what my sellers told me. No claim here. There was never any contact with Ms. Johnson or anybody from Coldwell Banker and Mr. Fuller.
Are you giving effect, you know, just assuming the facts are correct and not necessarily here, are you giving effect to the statute 3621A148 that makes a licensee liable for misrepresentations of the client if she has knowledge of the misrepresentation? Are you saying that that has no application here? And if that's your position, tell me why.
Okay. No, actually, I'm not saying that. I do want to point out, and we addressed this in our brief, that 3621A148 does not establish an independent cause of action against realtors. What it says is a client or a licensee is not liable for misrepresentation. It doesn't take away the common law cause of action, either statutory for deceit or common law for fraud. With that, though, you still have to get to reliance, and you still have to get to the causation between the alleged misrepresentation and the harm. And here, again, the actual...
Okay, now, I apologize for interrupting.
No, go ahead.
But you need to get to the reliance. What reliance? There's nothing There's nothing that I see in the statute that requires reliance. That, in looking at that, is principally a common law principle, is it not, and adopted by some states and rejected by others?
Yes, and just want to note real quickly, it has been adopted by South Dakota. But again, I'd point out that 3621A148, and we deal with it extensively in the brief, Justice Miller, but it says...
And by the way, I have read your brief, unless there's any doubt about it, I have read it.
I'll give you credit for that.
Okay.
We cite an Oregon case where the court in Oregon specifically said, hey, wait a second, we're not creating another cause of action here. We've got to go back to common law. What this is saying is you're not liable for misrepresentation just because you're the agent. Okay? Now, but it isn't pulling a realtor out and saying you're protected by being a realtor if you had actual knowledge.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Mr.
Voss, you have 10 minutes.
May it please the court, I would like to begin by dealing with the garage roof, and then, as time permits, going back to the alleged non-disclosures related to water penetration in the basement. Among the items indicated in the inspection that Fuller's inspector had performed was a sag in the garage roof, and Fuller's inspector is the one who indicated that the garage roof should be jacked up and a support beam should be added. There is an addendum to the contract that indicated that the Crostons agreed at their expense to have the roof jacked up and a support beam added. They hired a contractor by the name of Ron Lemke to do that work. The work was done prior to closing. Fuller looked at it, did not have it inspected by any expert, and then determined that it looked acceptable to him and agreed to close the contract. It's roughly 2 years later that Fuller decides that this repair has caused problems in other portions of the garage roof, that not this particular area, but other parts are now sagging as a result. He alleged in general terms that the Crostons have failed to fix the problem as was agreed to. However, this reference in general terms to fixing the roof is never what the Crostons agreed to do. The Crostons agreed to the specific steps that needed to be taken in order to make the property acceptable to Fuller to sell the property. And that was simply that the roof would be jacked and support beams would be added at that point where it sagged. And so this is not a case where the Crostons breached the contract. They did exactly what the contract required of them. They were not asked to and did not warrant the condition of the roof into any indefinite time in the future. They simply did what the contract language specified that they would do in dealing with the roof. To circumvent the actual text of the contract addendum, Fuller suggests a couple of theories. Fuller suggests one, that you should resort to extrinsic evidence to find that there was some general intent that the roof be fixed. Then second, he suggests that that there was an intention on the part of both parties that the roof be fixed and that there was a mutual mistake of fact when the jacking and adding the support beam did not in fact fix the roof. As far as extrinsic evidence is concerned, you first need to have an ambiguity before you can resort to extrinsic evidence, and there's nothing ambiguous about the terms that were used in this case. The contract stated precisely what was required, and precisely what was required was what was performed by the Crostons. As to the existence of a mutual mistake, the Crostons, of course, take issue that there was any generalized intention to fix the roof. There was a specific intention that the roof would be jacked up and a support beam would be added. Beyond that, there was no general intent to do anything to the roof because nothing in general needed to be done. And the further problem is that any mutual mistake wouldn't be a mistake of a present fact, but it would be a mistake as to the efficacy of this repair on into the future. And South Dakota precedent establishes that for there to be a mutual mistake, it has to be a mutual mistake of a present fact rather than a future one. And so the mere belief by Fuller that this jacking up and adding a support beam would repair the roof indefinitely into the future isn't a present fact existing at the time of the contract being entered, but it's an assumption or an opinion about a future facts which may or may not occur. But in any event, that's not a sufficient basis for a finding of mutual mistake and reformation of the contract language. If I can return to the alleged non-disclosure of defects, I think Mr. Landon has done a nice job of indicating what the actual record was that was in front of the circuit court when it made its findings of fact. And that Mr. Landon correctly pointed out that the opinion offered up by contractors after the work was, after the 8-inch rain that caused the leaking, was never entered into the record in the form of affidavits or deposition testimony. It was merely hearsay related by Fuller in his depositions, and as such, it was properly excluded by the trial court in its decision. And so the record shows that the only defect that was not disclosed was water penetration behind that wood paneling, which was a situation that the Crostons were equally unaware of. They had no knowledge of any water penetration occurring behind the paneling from the time that they had put that paneling up in 1977 until the point of sale in 2002. And so, as Mr. Landon pointed out, this is properly distinguished from the Engelhardt case, where there was about 4 days in between the paneling and the point where it went on sale. Here you've got 25 years of no known leakage occurring behind the paneling. It simply wasn't perceived or experienced by the Crostons during their course of ownership. And so the question that was posed earlier Mr. Glover is a correct one, is that if there's a full verbal disclosure, where are the damages based on the failure to provide written disclosure? And the correct answer is there's no damage because the buyer knew everything that the sellers knew. And so to impose a sort of a strict liability standard for the failure to provide a written disclosure when there was full oral disclosure is to reverse observation made by this court in Engelhardt that this is not a strict liability statute. And it would also be to ignore the statutory language found in 43-4-42, where it requires proof of actual damages suffered as a result of the non-disclosure. Here, any causal connection between the failure to make a written disclosure and the damages is broken by the complete oral disclosure, by the property inspection that was performed, so that at the end of the day, Fuller knew everything that the Crostons knew. There's no issue of fact as to that. And so I think we are dealing with a situation where there can't be any actual damages found as a result of the written disclosure because full oral disclosure did occur.
You have 2 minutes.
And I think I've said everything that I have to say.
Very well. So. Past 2 minutes. Thank you, counsel. Okay, Mr. Glover, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, a few points. Undisputed facts that we have here are supposed undisputed facts after the patio was taken out in 75 or 77, whichever it was, no water damage ever again. We then put paneling on the walls downstairs. Paneling shows water damage. No water damage after the patio was fixed. How does the paneling get water damage signs on it?
You mean the paneling, or do you mean behind the paneling?
The paneling itself. In Mr. Crossland's deposition, the reason he stated he asked Ms. Johnson for her opinion on whether they needed to disclose prior water damage was, I'm aware of a spot on the paneling on the east wall of the basement, and that corresponds to the patio that was replaced by this Four Seasons room or sunroom was the east side of the house. So, Proston State, no water after we did this repair. Paneling put on the basement, paneling shows water damage that the Crostons were aware of. He brought it up in his testimony and his deposition. As to the other facts on the people who repaired the basement, the guy's name that most of the evidence was, I shouldn't say evidence, but the facts come from, is Mr. Roy Johnson. All throughout Mr. Fuller's deposition, he states, and multiple times, he states that Mr. Johnson showed me places where there was extensive water damage behind that paneling of that wall. And while showing him those spots, or showing him how the wall crumbled, or showing him the rust on there, he stated there's no way that no one could have known that there wasn't water damage continually happening back here. Now, that is a hearsay statement, but I believe it's a present sense impression, which is an exception to the hearsay, and it can get in that way. But even without the statement, he was shown, Mr. Fuller had personal, he viewed it personally, he saw it himself, the damage back there. And there was some talk about Reliance and how there's damage on Reliance. I just want to touch on that quickly. The Reliance was Mr. Fuller relied on the Crostons and or Jamie Johnson and her assisting that the water had stopped coming in. That was his reliance. That's what was told to him orally. That's what everything had showed prior to the big rainfall and the water damage that we're now here about. His reliance was there was water damage. You won't have it anymore because we fixed it. He relied on those statements, and he relied to it to his own damage because that the evidence shows that reliance was misplaced. There's some dispute as to what the Crostons knew and what they did not know. There's some dispute as to who said to do what on the disclosure statement. There's some dispute as to if or when the water stopped coming in. All these disputed facts require this to go back and require that the jury decide this case. And additionally, these disclosure statements seem to be done in good faith. Good faith efforts are judged at a reasonable person standard. And under South Dakota case law, reasonable person standards normally are a jury question that cannot be done through summary judgment proceedings. So for those reasons, I would request that the summary judgment be overturned and this case be sent back for a jury to decide. Thank you.
Just a minute, please. Is there any, you've testified or you've stated that Mr. Croston indicated that he saw the water damage on the outside of the paneling?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any testimony that he told that to Janie Johnson of GKR?
Yes, Your Honor. In his... Mr. Croston's deposition, he was asked, do you remember the question that you asked Janie Johnson as you were going through this? This referring to his disclosure statement. He had stated that he and his wife had filled it out, but that Janie Johnson had assisted him. Mr. Croston's answer was, yes, I remember at least one. We were aware, you know, that there was a dark spot on that lower paneling on the east wall in that basement. And so we told her what had happened. We said, and I said, we, it hasn't happened for a long time. She said, it was a problem then? I said, yes. And she said, but you fixed it? I said, yes, we did. She said, did it ever happen again? I said, no. She said, if it was a problem and you fixed it, it didn't happen again, you don't have to. That's his testimony in his deposition.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.